This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Brian Miller. Brian is a former Inspector General for the General Services Administration. He worked at the Department of Justice for a number of years as well. I think 27 years of government service overall, Brian. Is that correct?
That's correct. 15 years at the Department of Justice.
Yeah. So, and Brian currently is the Managing Director for Disputes Investigations at Navigant. Navigant is a specialized global expert services firm that advises or navigates assist clients through disputes and investigations and regulatory issues. And Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. It's good to see you again, Roger.
Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation. And I think first, let's just get some of the some of the housekeeping out of the way, so to speak. And can you talk a little bit about Navigant and why you chose to transition to Navigant at this time?
Yeah, I'd love to. Navigant's a great firm. They do global investigations and disputes, and they do a lot of data analytics and forensics. And, I'm very interested in all those issues. And the firm has a great culture. It's very collaborative, yet it's entrepreneurial. So you can kind of make your own niche there. And so I like Navigant quite a bit. A lot of my friends are partners in law firms, and they tell me how Navigant is really at the cutting edge company. And so I'd like to be part of that and hopefully contribute to what they do. They service clients in all sorts of areas. And I hope to be working on issues related to white collar issues, government contracts issues, monitoring, all sorts of compliance issues, compliance risk assessments, and other issues. I've done a lot of litigation in my life, and so I'm sure I could be of service to clients in that area as well.
Well, I'm sure you can as well, Brian, and we'll get into a lot of those compliance issues and audits and all that fun stuff a little bit later in the show. I did want to also start out by talking a little bit about just the Inspector General's office. And you went to GSA, I guess, is 2005, is that correct?
It was confirmed in July of 2005.
Right. So, and GSA, somewhat unbiased, I work there. It's a small agency, it has a big impact, and it has $60 billion in annual spend go through GSA in one form or another. And interesting to get your thoughts, because I was at GSA at the time when you joined GSA, and what your impressions of GSA as a small agency with a big mission.
Yeah, well, Roger, you're exactly right. It has a huge mission, but it's not all that small. It has over 12,000 employees. I guess compared to DOD and HHS, it's not as big. But
well, I can tell you too, Brian, I started back in the 80s, and man, it was a lot bigger then too.
I bet it was.
Downsized quite a bit over the years, by two-thirds, I think.
Yeah, it was great meeting you. You were in FAS at the time, and it was great meeting you and the other people. But the thing that struck me was all the things that GSA does. I mean, they do all the things like federal contracts, government contracts, and federal buildings and leasing. And, as if that were not enough, they handle all the fleet of automobiles that are leased out to federal agencies, and that's huge. And then on top of all that, they do personal property, and we'll talk later on about the artwork that they're a custodian for.
Absolutely.
And
yep.
There's almost, they touch almost everything the federal government does in one way or another. And so it has a huge mission and a very difficult mission.
Right.
And so I was impressed at the size of the mission, the size of the agency, and the many, many things that they do. I was kind of overwhelmed by all the acronyms, but I learned that PBS was Public Building Service.
Right, sure.
It had nothing to do with television. But there were a lot of things. But the overall impression was this is a huge place with a big mission. And, you know, a lot of people who do a great job and never get recognized.
Right. Well, you know, that's, and it's true. It's the thing that always struck me about GSA, too, is just it's sort of caught in the middle, right? It's the nexus or the connection between customer agencies and the private sector. And that's a challenging place to be in any environment, but just, you know, and the way GSA in government contract world, that's a difficult mission.
Yes, so. Indeed.
So and one of the other things that I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about is the role of the IG at an agency and what that is from your perspective and sort of how it's evolved over time.
I think IGs are getting a lot more attention these days, and
that's true.
they're in the spotlight more. Whether that's a good thing or not, the future will tell. But Congress is relying on IGs quite a bit, so I see the role growing. But essentially, the role has been stated by the IG Act of 1978, which said that they are to improve the economy, efficiency, and effectiveness of programs, agency programs. And so we try and do that. And the Act also says that we root out fraud, waste, and abuse. So we do that too. So we have kind of a positive, I think they're both positive, but they also can be viewed negatively. So I like to tell people at GSA that our job is to help GSA do a better job every day. And we do that through auditing programs, and you know, we may find the program could be more efficient. And you know, first of all, nobody likes to be audited.
Right.
Nobody likes to be investigated. But the purpose is when we audit a program is to make the program better, and more effective, more efficient, and so that should be a positive outcome. And with investigations, you know, if someone is embezzling money from GSA, and we've had cases like that. GSA is the victim.
Right.
So we're helping GSA by preventing it from being victimized.
And the American taxpayer,
and
right?
The American more importantly, the American taxpayer. And IGs always view themselves as protecting taxpayers, American taxpayer and taxpayer dollars. And so so we're trying to save taxpayer dollars everywhere we can. But also GSA. We're protecting GSA and the victims. The times when GSA is victimized by individuals who are committing crimes or just general misconduct.
Which is rare, right? I mean, that's the...
We have a lot of great people at GSA.
That's where I was going, Ron.
And we have 12,000 employees, and that's a lot. Any town of 12,000, Roger, is going to have a jail. You go anywhere in the U.S., a town of 12,000 has a jail because somebody's going to do something criminal or something incredibly stupid, and you know the town is going to have to deal with them. Well, GSA has 12,000 people, and so occasionally you have people who commit crimes and do things that are not the best. So you know, it's human nature.
Right,
and,
sure.
And that's why you always need an IG, or you need a police department or a prosecutor. But ultimately, it's for the good of the town. It's for the good of GSA. And I think as an IG, you know, we do try and help GSA do work better and find ways to improve. And I think we've partnered with many parts of GSA very effectively. We have a great relationship with FAS, and I think that's increasing and getting better and better. We'll talk later on about our partnership with the Fine Arts Program and PBS. And so I think that's a fun part about being an inspector general. Of course, being an inspector general means, you know, you're not going to have a lot of friends.
Sure.
And, and you know, you're essentially telling Congress about what the agency is doing. You report to Congress.
Yep.
And, you know, Congress needs you to...
Is that the biannual reports? Biannual? Is that
what it is? Yeah, twice a year. Right. We do our reports.
Required by Congress.
Required by the IG Act of 1978, yep. Semi-annual reports. And we do them twice a year. And so we inform Congress. They often write us letters and ask us for more information. And, you know, we do provide information to Congress to help them in their oversight role, and they are relying more and more on IGs to give them information to help them do their oversight roles and
right.
duties.
So is that, do you think that's one of the biggest trends? I was going to ask you sort of trends there, or just what you see, and that the continuing or the growing reliance, particularly by Congress, on the inspector generals across government as sort of their eyes and ears. Is that a fair way to describe it? Or
I think that's fair. I think Congress is relying more and more on IGs.
Yeah.
And I know that even in my own experience at GSA, we had to talk to we worked with congressmen who weren't getting information from GSA. So one, you know, I remember one representative was trying to get information, and GSA, for whatever reasons, weren't providing information to him. And then he contacted my office. So I went to GSA and I said, well, why aren't you giving them this information? And they never did give him the information. So we gave him the information through our office, which is not ideal.
Right.
And I was trying to get GSA to work through it so they wouldn't have that problem. But that does happen occasionally. And so people on the Hill are relying more and more on IGs.
Yeah. Well, Brian, we do have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Brian Miller. He is the former Inspector General for the General Services Administration. Now he is Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And when we come back, we'll give Brian a moment to talk a little bit about his years at DOJ, and then we'll move on to some of the compliance issues, particularly in the area of MAS audits and the mandatory disclosure rule. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Miller. Brian is the former Inspector General for the General Services Administration. Brian is now Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. Navigant is a specialized global expert services firm that advises clients through disputes, investigations, and regulatory issues. And Brian, when we took the break, we're going to transition a little bit to your time at DOJ, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk. You mentioned you spent 15 years at DOJ, and from looking at your bio, you did many, many interesting things. So I wanted to, I know you worked on healthcare fraud in particular, but go ahead and talk about a little bit about what you did at DOJ.
I've been very, very fortunate, Roger, in my career. It's been amazing to look back and think of all the different things that I did. I worked at the Department of Justice originally, and then moved over to be an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. And then I had an opportunity to work for the Deputy Attorney General, first Acting Deputy Bob Mueller, and then Larry Thompson as Deputy Attorney General. And was a privilege to be involved in so many cases and in investigations, so many interesting things. I was special counsel on healthcare fraud for the Deputy Attorney General, and I coordinated all the healthcare fraud efforts of the Department of Justice. And every other week, I'd have a meeting of all the components, the FBI, the civil fraud, the criminal division, and we talk about where we would put our effort in terms of fighting healthcare fraud.
Right. Is that like Medicare fraud? Like when you occasionally, you see those stories of the doctors who've charged millions and millions of dollars through Medicaid or Medicare or whatever. So it's that kind of stuff?
Precisely. It's Medicaid, Medicare, and then DOD has its own healthcare, TRICARE.
Yes.
It used to be called CHAMPIS.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked at all the healthcare fraud, and then we managed a special fund with the HHS Office of Inspector General that would fund our healthcare fraud efforts at the department, the FBI, and HHS OIG. And so I had the privilege of being the special counsel for healthcare fraud for the department and representing DOJ in that effort, and it was a lot of fun. A lot of important cases came down. There was the
and a lot of money, right? I mean, that's a huge area, right?
Billions of dollars involved in healthcare fraud. A lot of large pharmaceutical companies and healthcare companies. I'd name some of the big settlements, but I'm not sure those companies would appreciate it.
Yeah, we can pass on that. Okay, Brian, we'll move on. Let's move on.
But it was a privilege to work in those areas. And at the Eastern District of Virginia, I was privileged to work on some of the terrorism cases. In the Misawi case, I handled a lot of the issues relating to sealed documents and unsealing documents and trying to get documents declassified and that sort of thing.
So you could use them in trial and that sort of thing? Is that for declassification?
And also there are a lot of interest in making some of these documents public. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
The last words of the firemen on 9/11, the radio transmissions were all recorded,
mm-hmm.
and they're transcribed. And so you have all these documents with the last words of these firemen. And, you know, they're very sensitive. We were going to use some of these at trial. So we didn't want the New York Times, for example, who intervened to get access to this information. We didn't particularly want that published by the New York Times if we were going to use it at trial. Endanger the fair trial rights.
Absolutely, yeah.
The
I understand that.
And Misawi. And so we were able to withhold some, but others, I thought, well, you know, I'd sit down with the New York Times and work out a solution. And we did. We settled the case, and the New York Times ended up publishing some, but they contacted the families of those individuals in the process. And so I thought we worked out a very nice solution, and the judge was happy with that too. And it was a privilege to work on those sorts of issues. I defended a federal magistrate judge in district court and in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and won both times. I even represented the attorney general in his personal capacity in a series of lawsuits that were filed in the Eastern District of New York arising from his actions around 9/11. And so just a great variety of cases. I was asked by the Department of Justice to go into a case in West Virginia where the U.S. attorney had been disqualified. They had convicted a drug kingpin and his crew, and they got life sentences. It was the biggest drug case they had. And then it turns out there's a huge problem. And so the judge wanted to reopen it. And so I led a team in to preserve the convictions of the drug kingpin. And so we had him panel a special grand jury, and we ended up adding charges. We had a little trial. It was a very interesting case and a very good resolution, at least from our perspective. And it was a privilege to do that. So I've done a lot of those cases. I did a lot of fraud cases. And in fact, that was I've done more fraud cases than anything else. False Claims Act cases, all sorts of cases. I've done both criminal and civil. And it's just been an amazing career when I look back over it in terms of the variety of cases that I was able to work on.
So you were very well prepared to become Inspector General at GSA, right?
Well, in some ways I was, Roger, because I was familiar with audits, but I'm not an auditor.
Right.
But I was familiar with audits, and I've worked with auditors and teams of auditors in some of these larger fraud cases. And I certainly understood investigations.
Absolutely.
I was very prepared on the investigatory side. Some things it's very hard to prepare for, you know, being called before Congress and testifying is a very difficult thing. Managing an office is a very difficult thing. Managing the sensitive relationships that you have with managers in the agency and with congressional staff and with the White House and
balancing
very sensitive
all those things.
Political issues that, you know, as a prosecutor, I was a career prosecutor, a career federal attorney, and as an IG, there is all of a sudden a lot of politics.
And nuance,
nuance, yeah. Right. And, you know, you get a request from Congress, and there may be a certain political agenda behind it, or, you know, there may be a group on the other side that doesn't want you to answer or wants you to answer in a different way. And so it's hard to prepare for issues like that. But in some ways it did prepare me, because in law enforcement, you just go where the facts lead you, and you have to be careful not to go beyond that. And you have to, but you can't be shy, and you can't be reticent to go up to where they lead. And
sure.
So, you know, I just went full speed ahead and let the chips fall where they may. And sometimes people liked it, sometimes people didn't like it. And so I feel that's the best way to proceed with anything, and just leave the politics to the politicians.
Right. And so you mentioned audits. So
yes,
that's a great
thing.
We want to do a segue to the multiple ward schedule program a little bit, and multiple ward schedule audits. And can you talk a little about the support the Inspector General's office provides the Federal Acquisition Service with regard to multiple ward schedule contracts?
Yes, we do reviews of the pricing. Pricing.
I know you keep saying
stations.
We. You mean GSA, the IG
right.
office.
Formally.
Right?
Formally. Thank you, right. Roger. I keep making that mistake.
It's okay. It's only been,
2 weeks.
Yeah, okay.
The GSA, Office of Inspector General, supports FAS, and they go through and they will review contractors' pricing, commercial sales practices. And so they do audits. They're called pre-award audits prior to award. The office will sometimes do post-award audits. And so, select companies to audit. They work closely with FAS. We have many joint committees with FAS to look at these issues. And I think, Roger, you at one time in your career were actually on a
yes,
committee.
Yes, I was on one of those committees.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so, we will look at companies to look at the commercial sales pricing and look at the pre-award pricing. So our auditors will go in, see if they have current, complete, and accurate sales pricing, and we will look at the pricing they give to other commercial customers. As the federal government, we believe that we are the biggest volume buyer, and that we are entitled to as good a discount as even the largest commercial purchaser. So we look to make sure the pricing is fair and reasonable. And so our auditors will do these audits. They'll give them to the contracting officer. And many times, not always, but many times we'll find that there are some discounts that are deeper than the ones being offered to the federal government in order to get onto the multiple awards schedule.
Okay. And you know what? Right now we do have to take a break, Brian, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the audit process and start working in mandatory disclosure and that sort of thing as well. My guest today is Brian Miller. He's the former Inspector General for GSA and now Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
CACI delivers innovative information solutions and services to serve America's highest priorities, advancing efficiency and performance with business systems, countering the effects of complex threats with integrated security solutions, providing healthcare solutions for better, more affordable care, defending the nation against cyber threats, and helping veterans with its award-winning career-building program. CACI. Information deployed, solutions advanced. Missions accomplished. CACI, ever vigilant.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Miller. Brian is a former Inspector General for the General Services Administration, and now he is Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And Brian, when we took the break, we had started talking a little bit about the multiple award schedule audit process, and you described, working with FAS to select the companies that those winners that get to be audited, with regard to their contract pricing and that sort of thing. And I think it might be good just take a couple minutes or whatever to describe the audit process from what companies should expect and how the Inspector General's office actually at the nuts and bolts like operational level engages the contractors when they're going to come in and to do an audit. So I'll turn it over to you.
Well, we work in conjunction with the FAS, and these audits are for the benefit of FAS. And so we're looking mainly at the largest contractors with large volume contracts. And so we look at a lot of different factors, but that probably is the key factor is, you know, what's the volume of contracts in dollars.
And isn't one of the reasons that is also, that's where the, you know, biggest theoretically bang for the buck. And I remember when I was right. there was a philosophy that every 3 years or so you tried to, maybe it was more to try to, you know, have a representative number of audits that would reflect the sales in the program, right? So yeah. then you have to pick the big,
sure.
bigger ones, right?
We're trying to be reflective of sales in the program. Mm-hmm. Now, we do throw in every once in a while a smaller one, so don't get too complacent out there. If you don't have a lot of contracts, you still okay. may get audited. But anyway, so having been selected for an audit, you'll be contacted from the Office of Inspector General, and they'll ask for documents, and they'll give you a list of documents that they expect to look at and information they would like. And you know, you can contact the individual on the letter and ask for a way to deliver that information. Auditors then may visit, and they may want information in order to understand how the system works and how the company's sales monitoring and billing systems will ensure proper administration of various provisions of the contract, including the price reduction provision of the contract. And every time a contractor signs one of these contracts, they agree to have an effective monitoring program. And so we do look at that as well. And so the auditors will come. They may talk with individuals. For example, they'll ask for something as simple as a directory. Sometimes companies don't have a directory, so the auditors may ask, well, can you tell us who's in charge of what? They will have an entrance interview where they will explain what the purpose of the audit is and what they plan to be doing. Company can ask questions at that point, and then they'll describe the process. So there shouldn't be any big surprises. And so once they analyze the information and they've conducted the audit, they'll have an exit conference. And they'll talk to the contractor at that point. They ultimately give their review to the contracting officer. The contracting officer, if it is a pre-award price audit or price attestation, they will give that to the contracting officer, and the contracting officer will use that to negotiate a schedule price, a fair and reasonable price to put on the schedules.
Now, audits and that information, that analysis is that typically shared with the contractor, or is that the decision of the CEO, or how does that work? Like, you know, 'cause that's always a question I get, like, do I get to see what the IG audit or the auditor's findings or how they got to them or what, how does that work?
Well, we do the audits for the contracting officer, and we produce the report to the contracting officer to use in the negotiation. And so our office will not share that with the contractor, but, you know, what the contracting officer does is up to him or her. And, you know, we do encourage them to use it in the negotiation. And, mm-hmm. and we think it's very helpful to them. And, you know, we've had times where contracting officers will sit down with the contracting officer, go through the audit, and they have an opportunity to say, I agree or I don't agree. And sometimes they'll agree 100%, and then they'll talk with the company and they don't get any lower price than what was offered originally. And, you know, and we've been working more and more with FAS. And so, you know, when that happens, we may contact someone.
The IG may contact someone.
Well, right. The Office of Inspector General,
right.
Someone in the auditors will contact yes. someone on the committee like you were on, Roger. And at some point, they may go back and ask the contracting officer to negotiate a little harder. And that's actually happened where they originally the contracting officer said they agreed 100% with the audit, but there was they didn't negotiate for a lower price. And then our auditors contacted people in FAS. The contracting officer then went back in, and they were able to get a much lower price put on the schedules, which the Office of Inspector General thinks is a good thing for the American taxpayer. And so that's the purpose of these audits, and that's essentially how they're conducted.
Is there any thoughts or recommendations you'd give a company who's going through an audit in terms of best practices or things to be aware of in dealing with the auditors?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just be open and honest. I think be prepared. Do your homework up front. You can anticipate that we're going to be doing these audits. You'll know that we're going to look at this information. You should go through and make sure that you actually know what the information is. A lot of companies are huge. They have regional offices. I know, you know, how when you have large companies with various offices, it's hard to keep track of the information. So if you know we're going to be coming in and auditing, get the information in order so that you can produce current, complete, and accurate information for us when we come in. And you, when you sign the contract, you say you'll have an effective monitoring system. You want an effective monitoring program and compliance program, and you may want to go in and do your own checks.
Right, like your own internal review.
Internal reviews and monitor, check, see how are you doing in applying the price reduction clause, for example. Or how are you doing in keeping track of labor charging? Do you have the right people with the right credentials on the right projects? And that way, you can improve your own contract administration, even if we don't do the audit. But if we do the audit, you should be in real good shape to face the audit. And, you know, communicate with the auditors. Make sure there's open lines, channels of communication. A lot of misunderstandings just escalate, and they're simply misunderstandings. And with more communications, you can avoid that.
Right, and that communication perspective is important to have. If you're a company, have a point of contact that the IG knows that they go to try to get to keep that line of communication open.
Yes, and the point of contact should be in contact with both the people in the company and the auditors, to make sure that information is flowing all the time. And, a lot of common sense rules. And I do think it's more and more important for companies to have these effective compliance programs and monitors.
Up front.
Yeah. And it really helps in all sorts of areas with any regulator, not just auditors coming in.
Yeah. On that note, I know when you were there, you were looking at trends in audit findings. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about what your office found with regard to the audit findings over time.
Well, we do these what we call roll-up reports to the commissioner of FAS, and so we look at various trends. And so we found that there was a trend of contractors misapplying the price reduction clause. And we found a trend of contracting officers not getting the discounts that our auditor showed they could get. Now I have to say that in over the last year or so, that's been improving. They've been getting better pricing, so they've shown some improvement. And the Office of Audits has a great relationship with FAS right now. And I think we're seeing results across the board. So I think the trends are getting better in that respect. There's still some problems with labor, what I call, as a former prosecutor, labor mischarging. But the auditors always used to correct me. It's like, no, you have to see if this person has the right training and credentials to be on this job. And so checking the right people are on the right jobs as advertised is an important factor. Compliance with the Trade Agreements Act is another big area, too.
Yeah. So, hey, Brian, we have to take our last break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Brian Miller, former Inspector General for the General Services Administration and Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And when we come back, we'll talk about the mandatory disclosure rule. Brian, during his time in government service at GSA, was one of the chief architects of how the rule looks and how it actually functions and works, and especially at GSA, but more on a government-wide basis as well. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Miller. Brian is a former Inspector General for the General Services Administration, and now he is Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And Brian, when we took the break, I introduced the idea of talking a little bit about mandatory disclosure rule. I guess first let's start with the big question. What the heck is that?
Well, several years ago when I was Vice Chair of the National Procurement Fraud Task Force, I wrote a white paper along with IG Rick Skinner over at DHS. We produced a white paper with legislative proposals, regulatory ideas. One of the ideas was to have contractors disclose crimes when they know of a crime and significant overpayments to IGs. The idea is that contractors are partners. If your partner is victimized by a crime, you would tell your partner. And so the idea is to have companies come in and report crimes they come across or significant overpayments. And the idea is that by working cooperatively with contractors, we will find out about significant overpayments that we may not have found out about otherwise. We don't have exhaustive investigatory resources. So ultimately, the taxpayer will get more money back. And our program, since we started it, has proven that out, that we've gotten millions of dollars back in recoveries that we would not have otherwise known about, but that companies have come forward and disclosed them. And so we look to it as a way to have a relationship with contractors and to have a very constructive relationship. So the idea is to have contractors come in and tell us when they have significant overpayment or when they have credible evidence to believe that there's a False Claims Act violation, a civil fraud, or a criminal fraud involved. And that has happened too. They've come in. Companies will come in and we'll work with them. Sometimes they will, fire people who were involved in criminal activity or even in misbilling, overbilling. And sometimes we've never referred a company that has come in and made a disclosure for suspension and debarment, but we have referred individuals that they have identified to us as, and said, look, they were the bad apples. And
right.
So we've referred those individuals to for suspension and debarment. I take that back. We did refer, I think, two companies, but they had made the disclosure after they were indicted.
So okay, a little late there, huh?
Yeah, there is a little timing issue.
Okay.
But it wasn't on account of the disclosures, on account of the
right,
indictment.
Right, the indictment, yeah.
But the normal companies coming in, we don't refer them. We view them as being presently responsible by disclosing.
Right.
You know, that they're working with us. They're working in good faith. They're the type of contractor we want to do business with, we think the government should do business with, because they're open and honest. And so our attorneys will work with the company officials or attorneys or outside attorneys. And I think that my office has a very good reputation with attorneys in town.
Your former office.
That would be my former office.
That's okay.
Has a great reputation, and they work well with attorneys in town and with companies. And I think that anyone who's dealt with us, my former office, finds that they're fair and reasonable and very even-handed. And so I think that generally they would agree they have a good result when they come in and do the disclosure.
Right. So now let's talk a little bit. I mean, you've covered some of the mechanics already of the clause. You got ahead of me here, Brian, but just a little bit. You know, there is the mandatory disclosure clause. It goes in all, you know, solicitations, I guess, pretty much these days. And it requires a number of things. One of the things that I think touches on something you talked about earlier is the idea of a compliance program or an ethics program, that sort of thing. I mean, that to me, the clause sort of reflects what's good business sense, right? And sense for a company. I mean, all companies should have that, right? Especially if you're doing business with the federal government. The federal government is unique from that respect. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. I think a robust ethics and compliance program is essential for any company in today's world. And I think it's a good thing for the company. I think it's a good thing, especially if the company is doing work with the federal government. In fact, if they're of a certain size, they're required to have a code of ethics and an effective compliance program. And it's also a good idea, I believe, is to for companies and contractors to monitor how effective is the program. Test it. Test to see if the company has internal controls. Test it in various areas to see if their effective controls are working in the area of contract administration, in the area of price reduction clause, even in the area of cybersecurity, any area. I think it's just a smart business move to have a monitor come in and check occasionally.
Right, and they can do that internally, or they could, like, talk to you about it right now.
Exactly, Roger, right. Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, you mentioned the term credible evidence, and I know that's a term of art in the clause, with regard to reporting, potential violations of the Civil False Claims Act, you credible evidence. Now, so I want to get your thoughts on this, because what I always understood is that language is designed to give a certain, it's part of the intent of that language, credible evidence, is to give a company an opportunity to do its due diligence to mm-hmm. figure something out, rather than thinking, seeing, oh, I see something, I got to immediately report it without having to take a look, see if it really does rise to that level or not. Is that a fair way to describe it?
No, I'm glad you described it that way, Roger. I think the way my former office looked at it is that we want companies to come in, and if they have serious allegations, they do a quick look. If they think there may be something to it, they disclose it to us and say, look, we're looking into this. And we'll report back when we've investigated it. My former office doesn't require anyone to do an internal investigation. If they prefer, the office will do it. But if they want to do their own internal investigation, that is even better.
Right.
And we only ask that you keep us informed, you know, that you talk with the attorneys for the Office of Inspector General and check in. It's better to communicate early and often. And, you know, as long as they're hearing from the company, they're not going to get worried. They know that the company wants to do the right thing, that they're doing the internal investigation, and they'll get back with the facts to the attorney in the Office of Inspector General.
Right. And so just real quickly, so that would be your best practices, sort of that early and often communication.
Definitely. And you know, make a clear communication. And if you don't know facts, tell them you don't know them. You don't want to get into a situation where you're saying things that you're going to have to correct later on.
Right, retract, right.
Or correct, or this wasn't quite right, or, mm-hmm. you know, you just want to be very careful and say, look, we're looking into it. We're doing an internal investigation, and if you're doing an audit, you may want to talk to them about your audit, make sure that you have the right protocols and that they're acceptable, because you don't want to go to the expense of having an audit and coming, you know, without communicating with the office and coming back and finding out that, well, it's not exactly what they were looking for.
Sure. Hey, and I know we're getting close to the end. We got a couple minutes left, Brian, but so I wanted to give you a chance. There's something having been all those years at GSA and been, you know, I'd left in 2007, but, the art, the stolen art program, and what your office does. What your former office, see, I do it too. What your former office did with that and what you did with that, I've read some articles about it and saw on PBS a thing about it. I'd like to hear a little bit more. And I'm sure listening audience would like to hear a bit about that.
It's a fascinating program because, as I said in the beginning, GSA does so many things. They are the custodian for what lawyers call personal property, and that's tangible items like paintings, sculptures, that belonged to the United States, because in the 30s and 40s under the New Deal art program, they paid artists, famous artists sometimes, for paintings up to $42. Wow. One now is worth $750,000. It was appraised on Antiques Roadshow, and it's hanging in the Detroit Institute of Art. So the taxpayer paid $42. It's now worth $750,000.
Good return there, I think.
Yeah, and it's a great program. It's a great opportunity for the Office of Inspector General to work with the Fine Arts Program. It's part of PBS, Public Building Service, at the General Services Administration. And early on, I invested resources into it. I saw it as a great way to show GSA how the Office of Inspector General actually adds value in a very immediate way. And so we collect these paintings that have been mislaid, or in some cases stolen. Mostly they're mislaid. I think most of the people innocently have these paintings.
Right. They were hung in their office or something. They take them home or when they retire or whatever. Even the office even gives them to them, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like, there was one famous painting that hung in a senator's office. He put it in the closet. And then the next senator said, clear all that junk out in the closet. And it was going to be thrown away. And the staffer said, I like this. I'm going to hang it in my house. And it went through a couple of generations, and then they returned it to us. When they heard we were actually looking for WPA art,
sure,
and so we always try to get the word out that we are looking for WPA art to return to the federal government. We put it up in museums, and we appreciate people who take care of it. Takes effort to care for it, make sure that it's not harmed. The fine arts program at GSA does refurbish it. And then we hang it up at a museum, usually at wherever the donor wants it hung up. We'll try and accommodate the person giving it to us.
What's the value of the art that your former office is?
There's the one painting of $750,000. There was another one that was appraised at $75,000. We don't collect all the values of it because we don't plan on selling them, so we don't them formally appraised.
And but it's part of American history.
Part of American history, and they are hanging in a lot of museums. There's an Andrew Winter painting, Gulls at Monhegan Island, that is extremely valuable, and that's back in our custody as well. And there's some very valuable paintings that belong to the U.S. So in terms of dollars, it's quite a few dollars. But the best value is to have all Americans enjoy the paintings that picture America during the 30s and 40s.
Right.
And there's some great scenes.
You know, even I can remember as a GSA employee, sometimes you'd get reprints, you know, as gifts or as acknowledgement of job well done, that sort of thing, which I think is perfectly okay. That's a great story, Brian, and it's a great way to end the show. I want to thank my guest today, Brian Miller. He is a former Inspector General for the General Services Administration, and now he is Managing Director for Disputes and Investigations at Navigant. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.